Hey, this is Texas country musician Bree Bagwell inviting you to check out my podcast, Only Vans. Listen, love it, and subscribe now on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts. It's where I come to you from my backyard in my van. Well, actually, we upgraded to an RV, but it still has the front end of a van, so it still counts. So basically, I get all my friends and we sit right here with my dog. This is Whiskey. And we talk about important things like feet pictures, getting told you look tired, dating in the music scene. Listen, love it, and subscribe now on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, and welcome. It's Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I am Cindy Howes. Thank you so much for joining me today. We are talking to New England folk queen Chris Delmhorst, who is releasing her new record, Long Day in the Milky Way, into a very weird world. On the podcast, Chris mentioned that the act of performing songs from a new record night after night on tour really allows her to grow close to the album and to get to know the songs really well, which will be interesting to see what effect that will have on her in the future for this album that won't be performed on tour because of the pandemic. Raised in Brooklyn, Chris Delmhorst was a huge music fan growing up. She taped the weekly Top 40, read Rolling Stone cover to cover, and had Harry Chapin's sister as a grade school teacher. She played the kids the Beatles' Help versus Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle, which is a good choice. She studied classical cello and talks about her complicated relationship with classical music presently. Chris worked on a farm in Maine and found her love of playing music with friends and creating community there. These days, she thrives on weaving together her close friendships with her music. On her new record, she centers the music on the harmonies performed by herself, Rose Polanzani, Rose Cousins, and Annie Lynch. She says, I was thinking about the variations in a hand-woven cloth or in a forest, which is kind of hard to expand on, but really when you hear the record, woven fabric definitely comes to mind. We talk about how she met her husband, singer-songwriter Jeffrey Foucault. It's fun talking to Chris. I loved hearing how much of a music geek she was as a kid. She loves pop music from her youth so much that in 2011, she made a Cars cover album. Chris Delmhorst is just a wonderful person. So thrilled to have her on the podcast. Her new album, Long Day in the Milky Way, it's out now, unless you're listening to this on Thursday, in which case it's out tomorrow. But we're going to take a listen to a song from the new album, Wind's Gonna Find a Way, and then we'll get to our conversation with the wonderful Chris Delmhorst on Basic Folk.
Long day in the Milky Way, hammering my heart against a heavy door. All doubt round about, and he used to wonder what the pounding's for. Don't worry, 'cause
this is so great. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Hey, Cindy. Psyched to see your face, even in a little tiny screen.
Chris Delmhorst was an early booster of Basic Folk and also one of the many strong suggestions that I include song clips in the podcast. So I just want you to know that's a Chris Delmhorst original.
You're welcome.
It's all because of you. Actually, I heard it from a few people, and then as soon as I heard it from you, I was like, geez, I better do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, all right.
Power.
This is going to be fun. So let's talk about growing up in Brooklyn. What part of Brooklyn did you grow up in, and what was your neighborhood like, and wondering how you might still feel connected to it?
That's funny because my parents just left the house for our first visit since the whole thing started. And so we were talking about it a bunch. I grew up in a neighborhood called Brooklyn Heights, which is a super nice neighborhood right near where the Brooklyn Bridge lands. But, you know, it's just like a pretty mellow residential neighborhood, and it's really cute, and like they would film movies there. Moondance, what is it called? Moonstruck got filmed around the corner from my house. Wow. Also, many episodes of soap operas.
Street. I bet.
Yeah, and it's, and also my parents both grew up in Flatbush, in a neighborhood that I think they're calling now Ditmas. And so that was also, that was like the big Victorian houses with a yard and stuff. So that was my grandma's house growing up. That was also kind of my other neighborhood.
Is that, are they, so they're native New Yorkers. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, many, both of them born and raised. And
how many generations of New Yorkers are you?
It depends. The furthest one back is, well, I don't know. This is my mom's department. Most of them, most of my grandparents were either first or second generation, but my mom's dad, those guys go way, way back.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't even know how far. Yeah. Whenever I play at Jalopy, which is a little club in Red Hook, I go around the corner because my, I think, great, great grandfather had a tailor shop right around that corner. And there's like the deep Brooklyn roots.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And then did you have siblings growing up?
Yeah, I have one sister who's younger.
Cool. And then was it a big age difference?
She's 3 years younger than me. So
that's pretty good.
Yes. It's kind of like normal-ish.
So, like, I'm from the suburbs, and I always find it, like, very interesting to hear, like, what you did when you were kids, like, how you played in your neighborhood. So how would you and your sister play in your neighborhood together?
Yeah. You know, we didn't really play in our neighborhood together very much unless it was the only times I can really remember us playing together outside in the neighborhood was in a giant snowstorm when everything would shut down and we would like make igloos between the cars and stuff that were parked on the street. But we, you know, it wasn't really, it's funny now because I live in a tiny town now with a ton of outdoor space and my daughter's 12, and so she's sort of old enough now that I am constantly comparing how I grew up with how she's growing up, and it's so different. But there really wasn't such a thing as, like, go out and play. That wasn't really a thing. I had a friend who lived on a short, not a dead end, but, like, a short one-block street that had really low traffic, and that's where people would play kick the can and stuff like that in the street and stoop ball and whatever. But that was only when I was at that friend's house. And then besides that, we like hung out in the house, in the apartment a whole lot. And then, or we would like go somewhere where it made sense to be outside. But we wouldn't really, I don't know, we just didn't really play outside. In the summer, we would go to the beach a lot. And that's when we would just like, you know, goof around in the sand and the water and whatever. So we shared a bedroom. We were just talking about this, my family. We shared a bedroom until I went to college, which was my dad just confirmed for us 9 by 12 feet. And so we sort of had enough. We had enough of each other all the time.
Wow.
Pretty much.
Yikes.
I know.
Your dad worked on Wall Street and your mom was a school administrator. Are they retired at this point?
Yeah, my dad's been retired for a long time. He sort of got out of that scene when I was in high school and worked a variety of other jobs since then. But the Wall Street thing was not super healthy.
Right. That seems so, just knowing your personality, I don't know your dad at all, but like it seems so counterintuitive to what I know about you.
It was almost sort of the family business for him. And, he's not like a, what do you call it? He's not like a hedge trader or any of those kind of things. He was what's called a two penny broker, where he was one of the guys running around with pieces of paper down on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, like in Trading Places. And so he did it, and he did a good job and everything. And I think he always liked the relationships. I mean, he's a very social guy. And so wherever he goes and whatever he's doing, it's kind of about the relationships that he's forming. But I think it was a little bit of a weird fit, and it definitely exacerbated some coping stuff that he had going on in his own life. So he got out of that, which was great for everybody, and has done a lot of different things since then. And my mom, yeah, right around that time, a little before that, I guess my mom started, for a while when we were little, she stayed home with us. And then she went to design school for a while and was doing some, you know, self-employed. She had a stenciling business where she would like stencil people's walls. And then eventually she got back into school, yeah, on the administration side. And then she did that until she retired.
Nice. What kind of parents were they like?
That's a good question. They were good. I saw a lot more of my mom when I was younger because my dad was doing that job. But on the weekends, it was a very musical family, and that like that really was a big part of growing up with those guys. And some of my happiest memories, I think, of being all together with the family would be singing or making up harmony to things, or you know, acting out little shows and stuff. Or my dad had some like greatest hits on the piano that we would beg him to play, and then he would play them sometimes if we, you know, could wear him down. So yeah, they were really just super supportive, and especially of creative stuff. They're both people that love music and love really any kind of creative pursuit. And so that was lucky, being a kid who was into that stuff, because they definitely were willing to give it a lot of room and a lot of like respect.
Your mom and dad grew up singing in the church choir, and it sounds like they continue choir at church, hopefully not now, no. As adults, like when in the normal, the before times, and hopefully when we get back to normal. What do you take away from that experience of performing music in a church? And if at all, how do you approach religion and music now?
Interesting. Yeah, my parents have known each other for, I think, 76 years. They met when they were little toddlers, basically, at a church in Brooklyn out in Flatbush. And they did sing together in a choir in my neighborhood for about 35 years. And then they quit doing that because they were sick of Sundays being taken up, and they started doing they're in a chorale group, the New Haven Chorale in Connecticut. They moved up to Connecticut. And so, yeah, they've both been singing their whole life. And I remember really clearly my dad when I was, because we had to go to church, and it was a congregational church. It was a fairly low-key situation, but it was still church, and it was still Sunday morning, and it was during the top 40, and we had to go. I taped the top 40.
With Casey Kasem?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so anyway, we...
Wait, you would tape the top 40?
I would tape the top 40 every Sunday.
That's before. Awesome.
I know. I had to use one of the really long tapes. It was like 120-minute cassette tape, and it only worked once I got a new CD player that would like auto flip it.
Oh, you know,
because church is long. It's really long. Anyway, yeah. So yeah, I had to go, and as soon as I could, I started singing in the choir too, because it was just so much more interesting than just attending church. And I remember talking to my parents about that when I was pretty young, probably, I don't know, a young teenager. And I really remember my dad saying something about how for him, the music was what God was, really, or what like worshiping was to him. Like that's where it lived for him, and that's what it meant to him. And I think the rest of church, you know, they did it because they were used to it and it was part of their life. But for them, it was really about connecting with the music, and that was where the meaning came in for them. And that was definitely, I mean, I was never a huge church fan, to say the least, but the parts that I did like, and something that I still sometimes think about and miss, is just that very specific feeling of being like one voice in a big choir, and it's not about you personally, and it's not even really about the people in the choir. It's about you know, you're singing to connect to this larger force, you know, and that is cool. I remember I went to see my parents' singing group recently, and there was a soloist, and I was just watching her sing in this big church, and I felt like she was singing this, you know, sacred music, and I felt like I could almost see it was like her feet went into the ground and then became these roots and just were like tapped into this immense thing that she, it was so not about her. And it gave this power to her singing that it's, it was just so much bigger than her, I guess. Mm. And that's something that I find myself kind of following, you know, just, and I think that a lot of, for me, that oftentimes lives in the experience of singing with other people. And just like being one voice of many. I mean, I know that's ironic because I have chosen as my life to be like the singer, but it's, that's what I love more than anything.
All right, let's talk about listening to the Beatles and discovering the Beatles when you were five.
Where'd you look, Cindy?
Under rocks.
You've got all the rocks. I love it. Yeah. The Beatles was the first band that I was even aware of, I think, being a band. And it was definitely the first music that made me just like lose my mind. And I have such a clear feeling. I think it was actually in kindergarten and we had this loft thing and the song Help came on, I guess. My kindergarten teacher was Harry Chapin's sister, believe it or not. Well, and she used to play like all kinds of music in the room. She was really cool. So she put on the Beatles. She must have put on the record Help, and Help was the first song. And it just made me feel so much more than I knew what to do with at that time, that I just, it was like a physical freak out, because it just made me, it was the part, the line that killed me was Help me get my feet back on the ground. And it's because, I think because I was, little kids are so literal, you know, and but also tapped into all of the sort of hidden forces at the same time. I just found that line hilarious, and it made me just crazy. It made me want to jump out of my actual skin and like freak out. So yeah, that was the first, like that moment of being transported by that song, I've never forgotten. It's funny. I don't know. And I don't even know if it was like, maybe it could have been Led Zeppelin, you know, maybe it could have been, you know, Heart. I don't know, like whatever, yeah. Like whatever I heard, like maybe that would have been the thing, but it was, I was definitely ready to like get deeper.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then did Harry Chapin's sister ever play you Taxi or Cats in the Cradle? Probably had a different effect.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably not the same feeling. A little more subdued.
You mentioned recording the top 40 countdown. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear more about your fixation on the radio as a kid, and how did it play an important role in your musical tastes?
Well, the radio, I remember sort of like finding the radio when I was maybe 11 or something like that. And it was kind of like finding a portal to my people, kind of was what that felt like. Because I was really, really obsessed with songs, and really also living in a very nice but still two-bedroom New York apartment with my parents and my younger sister. And so I always felt a little like crowded, and a little, probably a little bit trapped. And so like just having this, it was like a tunnel opening to another world that I could, that was my world, you know? And so I would listen to the radio all the time, drive my sister completely nuts. It was like, you know, it was just this process of like pulling on one little thread of the, you know, weaving, and then just letting it and following it where it went, which was all over the place. I would just like listen to, I mostly was listening to at first just like WPLJ, which was just like the top 40 station, which in 1982 was playing like, you know, a lot of Eagles, and then like, you know, some started to be like Madonna stuff. There was a lot of classic rocky things. There was a lot of, you know, top 40 like pop of the moment, and I was into everything, and I had my tape deck with the on record and pause all the time, and whenever a song came on, that I was into, I would, you know, take it off pause. So I had just like tapes and tapes and tapes, cassettes of all of my little mixes that I made when I was 11, 12, 13 off the radio.
Isn't it funny with those tapes? I used to do that too. And I think like still to this day, when I hear like certain Counting Crows songs or certain songs from the 90s, I hear like the radio bumper like afterwards, like
totally
the little like do, 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 do.
The, yeah, yeah. The radio or you hear jingle. The DJ, like, I always, there's certain songs that I can almost still hear what the DJ was saying. And the DJ would always like talk over the whole intro. And you'd be like, dude, shut up. I'm trying to record the song. And he's just like talking and talking over the whole intro. And I can still hear like,
that's called hitting the post.
Hitting the post?
Yeah.
Dudes like to hit the post hard on WPLJ in the 1980s.
Yep. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. But I have a funny story for you about the top 40.
Go on.
Which is that I was obsessed with Journey for a little while, and I had a huge crush, unlikely crush, on Steve Perry, which I actually just showed my daughter some pictures of him just to freak her out and tell her that I had a crush on that guy. And anyway, I loved his voice so much, and that's all that mattered. And I had managed to tape all their songs off the radio that I really loved, except Separate Ways. And I waited for months and they didn't play it, and they just kept not playing. I kept not catching it, and it was driving me crazy. So I sent in a did you ever listen to Casey Kasem Top 40?
I listened to Rick Dees.
Okay. Well, I don't know if he did this, but what Casey Kasem would do was every week he had a long distance dedication.
Yeah.
And so someone like would write in their like incredibly dramatic story about why they needed the song played for them or for somebody else. And then he would read their letter and then he would play it. So I wrote a request for a long distance dedication for my non-existent older brother, Kyle, with a K-Y-L-E. Because he was in prison, Cindy, but he was wrongly accused.
Wow.
And the only way that I could get a message to him to keep his spirits up in prison was if Casey played him Journey Separate Ways.
Did it happen?
No, it didn't happen. Ugh. I don't think so. I mean, every now and then I would miss it, but I never heard it. But it was a really good letter, and I could imagine him reading it in his voice. I really felt like it was going to work. It was a good letter.
How old were you when you wrote that?
I think I was probably 12 or 13.
Wow.
I think. It just started raining really hard here, in case you're wondering if you can hear that. That's what's happening.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm into it. Yeah. I read that you would read Rolling Stone like pretty religiously, and then did that like thing that I don't know if it still happens anymore for young people discovering music. It's so much easier now than it was, you know, back then, where you would kind of like work backwards looking for musicians' influences. Can you talk about forging that path of discovery back then?
Mm. Yeah, it was such a it was a real practice. It was like one of the things I did, you know, was like I got Rolling Stone and I got Spin, and I'd read the whole thing when I got it, and I'd read everything, the record reviews, every single thing, you know. Bands that I knew, bands I didn't know, whatever. And then it's kind of like, I feel like it's sort of like building a map without a map, you know, without like GPS, like building a map of the music landscape, just like little dot at a time. Like you get one thing and you're like, okay, I like this record by, you know, Led Zeppelin. I'm super into this. And so then you like read an article about Led Zeppelin and they start talking about blues guys. You know, they mention like Muddy Waters and you're like, what's that? And so then you kind of like find Muddy Waters, which would involve taking the subway up to Tower Records, like riffling through the blues bins, whatever, finding the CD, being like, is this the CD I'm going to spend my $15 on, or is it not today? And then like getting it, bringing it home, absorbing it, you know, just like huffing it. And that's what I kind of miss, I think, now about everything being so available, is like the preciousness and the like the stakes at that point were pretty, you've already invested a lot in the idea of this record, and so you would really like follow through on that, you know, and it wasn't just like listen to the first song or two and be like, eh. You'd be like, I'm listening to this whole damn record. I'm going to listen to it at least three times, even if I don't like it the first time, you know, because like you went somewhere for that record. So that
it wasn't convenient.
I mean, you also end up with like a whole lot of CDs that you spent money on that you don't like. So that's like the downside. But I do that, just that feeling of like, oh my God, here it is. I finally have it. I'm going to dig it. And I'm just going to like, that's what I'm doing right now. So I'm going to receive this record and see what it is, you know. But anyway, so you would like get the Muddy Waters record and listen to that and be like, this is amazing. And then find where that went. And it's like just building the web of connections as you understand them, just like little tiny piece by piece. It's cool.
Yeah, it is. That is a really cool practice. And also in thinking about like, you do have to spend a lot of money on CDs that you don't like.
That's the problem.
Did it ever occur to you to like go to the library to get CDs?
Never, not once.
Yeah.
And I don't really know if that was even a thing.
Yeah, it probably wasn't a thing until it was like too late.
Exactly. Exactly.
You studied classical cello and then went on to study it at Manhattan School of Music. What has been the evolution of your relationship with classical?
So classical music, it was my work almost at that time. And there were a few things that I would put on and listen to for fun, but not much in those days with classical music. And now I can put it on and really love it. But to me, it's like reading a book more than it's like listening to music. Like music, you can put on and then live your life with that in the background. And if I'm going to, like, Jeff goes through phases where he's going to put on, like, you know, New World Symphony, like put on Dvorak or something and listen to it. And I can't even talk to anyone. If anyone tries to say anything, I can't talk to people. I can't do anything. Like if that stuff's on, it's takes my whole brain as if I am reading a book. And, so I don't know. And it's especially if it's something I've ever played, then it's really it just commands my entire attention. So I love it. But it's actually pretty rare that that situation comes up that I can really pay attention to music. But, you know, when I hear something, especially a piece that I have a relationship with, you know, when you learn a piece of music, even if it's like learn a cover song or learn, you know, you know, My Darling Clementine or anything you learn, like you're putting a little bit of time into it and you're building a relationship with that song. And then if it's something really hard, like a cello concerto or something, then you're putting months and months of practice into that piece. And so it's like that stuff, it's like a physical part of me at this point. You know, if I hear something like Brahms Cello Concerto, which is one of my favorite things to play, if I hear it now, it's almost like a physical event to hear it, like my hands hear it, you know, and like my whole kind of body remembers what it feels like to play that stuff. And it's hard to describe, but it's a weird relationship. It's kind of intense, I guess, my relationship with classical music, and I don't listen to it all that often, probably for that reason. It's kind of tiring.
Hey friends, you probably know that here at Basic Folk, we are not only podcasters and music fans, but we are also feminists. Folk music feminist Lizzie No is here with an important ask.
Hell yeah, Cindy. Okay, so we can all agree that abortion is healthcare. But if you live in the state of Tennessee, you will need to travel over state lines in order to access that healthcare. It's the worst. I work with an organization called Abortion Care Tennessee, and we are currently raising money so that we can make sure Tennesseans have access to reproductive healthcare in spite of our state's bullshit abortion ban.
There's no better time than right now to fund abortion, especially since the National Network of Abortion Funds is doubling donations between now and May 31st. Just go to abortioncaretn.org and click on the donate button. Then choose the option that says donate for fundathon.
Thanks for joining the fight for reproductive justice. Abortion forever, no matter what.
No matter what. You transition from cello to fiddle, and you said they're pretty similar. What if your classical training remains in your fiddle playing and even in your guitar playing?
Well, I mean, fiddle, I did learn fiddle because I would never say that fiddle is not that different from cello, but the people that I was living with who were trying to get me to be, I was living on a farm in Maine after college, like a back to the land kind of, sort of like a hippie homestead kind of self-sufficient farm. And so like
where we learned about back to the landers from Anais Mitchell. Her parents were back to the landers.
There you go. Exactly. I basically went to a Maine version of Anais's parents and worked for them for room and board for a year. That was my first move out of college. And while I was there, and the guy that I worked for played in a for contra dances, which are sort of like the New England version of square dances. It's the traditional Northeastern like community dance. And so I was playing, the guy that I was working for played guitar in a band for contra dances. So like traditional tunes, Appalachian tunes, Irish tunes, Scottish, old time, that kind of stuff. And first he got me to play the upright bass. He had an upright bass and he was like, oh, that's like cello. You should come play bass in the band. And so I started playing bass in the band, which I didn't play bass up until then, but I, you know, figured it out and started playing bass. And then the fiddle player went to Mexico or something for the winter and they were like, now you're the fiddler. It's just like the cello. Go. So then I learned all these fiddle tunes really quick. So I'm really like, I'm not a good fiddle player and I have no classical technique whatsoever. I don't know even how to hold the bow, honestly, as like a fiddle player. I just made that up. And by the time anyone came along who could teach me better, all my habits were completely ingrained. So I'm really like, I can't just play like one beautiful note on the fiddle. I can just screech a bunch of fiddle tunes like all day long, but I can't really just like make a nice sound. And so I don't know. And in terms of the classical stuff, I felt like there was so much unlearning. Like many of the early years of playing other kinds of music had to do with really pushing away so much of what I had learned. Yeah, like the music that I learned, my favorite thing was always orchestra. And it's kind of like what we were talking about before with being one voice in the choir. I just really like to be one sound in the middle of this big ocean of sounds that just really was a thrilling feeling. And the way that those, you know, like symphonies are put together, that's kind of like the cars also. There's so many moving parts, you know, there's just like, it's built in this way that's really fascinating. And I know that that certainly in my newest record, that came into play a little bit. So I think maybe it's more like generally speaking, the way I think of music is still informed by just like living and so immersed in classical music for those years.
You met Jeffrey Foucault on tour in Ireland with Peter Mulvey.
Yes, actually in England, but that's pretty close.
Oh, in England. Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you set the scene for what that tour was like and how you two first started really connecting?
Yeah. That tour, it was in January of 2003, and Mulvey set it up. He was sort of the connection between us because I had never met Jeffrey and I had never met, but we both knew Mulvey because Mulvey's from Wisconsin, where Jeff is from, and they had connected there. But Peter had also been living in Boston quite a bit, and I knew him from there. So I can't even remember how it came about that he decided to put together a three-person bill to tour the UK, but he did, and he asked us both to do it, and we both said yes. And And the idea, it was just a triple bill. There was nothing particularly, there were no big plans aside from just everyone plays their own little set and maybe we'll play an encore together, you know, that kind of thing. It was that kind of show. And so we went over there and started playing these shows, and the shows were fine and they were just sort of, everyone was playing their little set. But then the really great part about that tour was after the show and before the show, just playing songs with the three of us, like in the hotel room, we just were playing all the time and just kind of, I think we were all at a point in our musical development. Like, I don't know if that would happen right now for me at this point in my life. Like, we'd probably play some songs here and there, like in the green room or whatever. But if you're on tour now with other bands, like you're not necessarily going to spend every waking moment like playing every song you've ever known with them. But we were all...
Unless you came of age musically with... Back to the Landers.
Well, I guess so. That's true. I don't know. know. It was just kind of the moment where that just made sense. Like, no one was very jaded yet, I guess. No one needed to just, like, go to their hotel room and have some them time. Everyone was like, yeah, playing songs is what we like to do. Let's keep doing it now that the show is over. So we just – we played a ton of songs. We played everything any one of us had ever heard or, like, kind of knew or didn't even really know but thought they remembered hearing one time. Like, we just played a trillion songs. And it was so much fun. And we also played a lot of cards. We played a lot of poker. So I think it was a two-week tour. And everyone was – everyone was, like, had a partner at that time. So that was – it was, like, very – you know, it wasn't like we got together on the tour, which would have been a whole different tour experience, especially for Mulvey. But it was just like we just all hung out all the time. And so that was where the Redbird project came from, because basically our thought was on this whole tour, we just kept thinking, like, the show is okay. But what's really interesting is playing these songs that we kind of know afterwards. That seems much more entertaining. It was certainly more entertaining to us, but we felt like it would be probably more entertaining for anyone. So that was the idea with Redbird, was to try to, you know, try to, like, capture that in a shareable way. The more informal, you know, song swap, friends swapping songs kind of vibe.
On the new record, Long Day in the Milky Way, you said, I was thinking about the variations in a hand-woven cloth or in a forest. It's called for collective-minded, flexible, non-ego-driven players, which that's a great description. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that a little bit more, like where that metaphor of hand-woven cloth or the forest came from when thinking about the musicians that you would want to work with?
I was thinking about fabric a lot while I was writing the songs, and I just kind of got into that idea of a song being sort of, instead of a, like, story from point A to point B to point C, which isn't necessarily how I write anyway, but, like, that a song would really be almost like a substance, you know, like a, that didn't even necessarily have a beginning and an end. Like, you could almost loop it back and just have it be sort of a continuous, I don't know. I still haven't figured out how to talk about this without just sounding so much like a hippie, but just like a continuous, like, loop of something that the whole shape of it, rather than, like, here's the first chorus, here's the second chorus, it's bigger, here's the bridge, you know, like, just that it was more about, like, the subtle build and, like, gradations in something that was more uniform. I don't even remember how I got into it. I just kind of, that's what I was thinking about a lot with when I was writing the songs. And so then in recording them, it came up again, partly because I had already really just been focused on that idea in the writing, but also because I really wanted the record to be about singing most, and about me singing with Rose Polanzani and Rose Cousins and Annie Lynch, who are a sort of trio of singers that kind of go with me through the whole record, and they're very present, and sometimes they're singing with me, and sometimes they're kind of answering me, and sometimes they're contributing other, like, thoughts to the songs. And so for me, that was the center of the whole record, was the was that group of voices. And so I really wanted the instruments to be, to, like, hold that, you know, to be, to wrap that in something. And so I didn't want it to be so much about, like, here's the guitar solo or whatever, but just to make, like, a landscape that would, that it's sort of like walking through a landscape. I feel like the music that those guys made, where you're sort of just walking through it, and then something catches your eye a little bit. It's not like a huge event, but it's like some little thing that Mari does on the harp, or some little guitar thing where you're like, oh, check that out. You know, it's just like, maybe you see a little, like, flower as you're going by or something, you know, or like, oh, look at that cloud, you know. So that kind of, like, environmental, I sort of wanted to make, like, an environment of music for the voices to live in.
It's nice. There's a song on the record called Hanging Garden. And this is where we talk about plants. You were the very first guest on Marcarelli's video series Ology, and you were focusing on plants. Was it called Herbology or Plantology?
I think it might have been Plantology. I can't actually remember. I think it was Plantology.
Can you tell me where your interest in plants comes from?
Well, I mean, I'm a farmer by trade. And when I first got out of college, I worked at that farm we talked about. And then I kept working on farms pretty much until I had to quit because I had to go on the road.
Did you have experience before you went to that farm?
No, not at all, because I was such a city girl. And I'm from Brooklyn and I never wanted to leave Brooklyn. I had no intention of ever leaving whatsoever. And I was positive I was staying there for the rest of my life because I loved it so much. And so I went to college in New England in a small town specifically because I was like, this is my one chance to go somewhere else and live somewhere that's not New York City before I come back and stay here for the rest of my life. And then I never went back because I went to a small town and I got super into, I was doing a little kind of agricultural program and I got really into that. And I got just fascinated by the whole idea of rural living. And so then I went to this farm in Maine and I lived there for a while. And I was such a moron, you know, and I was like a pretty street smart kid. And then I went to this farm in Maine and I just knew absolutely nothing. Like I didn't even know how to walk. I knew nothing, you know, I was useless. And which was, I think, a cool experience for me at that time to just see how much my skills really did not apply at all to the situation. So I just like screwed up and screwed up and screwed up. And, but I just got really into the whole idea of rural life and like living connected to the land. It was so completely different from anything I had ever done. And I just really went deep with it. So I worked on farms in Ireland. And then when I moved to Boston, I started working on farms out in Lincoln and Concord. And so that was my day job that I had eventually quit for music. So yeah, plants. I have a big garden here and grow a ton of food. And there's a lot of plants that creep into my songs.
You have an actual concert for human beings in person.
Oh my God, I know.
It's happening. Actually, when this podcast comes out, it will not have happened yet. August 18th in Hatfield, Mass.
It's so surreal.
What have you missed about performing for live people in these past few months? And do you have any idea how you think you'll react to like returning to the actual experience?
I mean, it's a little scary, you know, partly it's just sort of, it's heavy. It feels heavy to be the reason for people assembling in any way. Like that definitely feels a little scary. But I trust very much that the Signature Sounds crew have like thought of every last thing and they're managing this thing so well and everyone's going to be super distanced and masked up and all the stuff. So I feel like, you know, in terms of the responsibility angle, I'm definitely okay with it, although it's still, I can't help but feel a little bit like twitchy about it. But in terms of performing, I actually feel terrified because I've never gone this long, ever since I started, without playing for people. And it is something that I sort of feel like I forget how to do. I don't forget how to play music, but I definitely forget how to be up in front of people, which is not really my natural tendency to want to be the center of attention. So it's kind of something that I can get really rusty with really quickly because it's just not natural to me.
Right.
And so, but it's, I like it and I'm practiced in it, but once I'm out of practice, it's like, I really get out of practice. So
right.
I don't know. I don't know how
it says the girl who just wanted her family to go away.
I know. So I don't know. I think it's going to be, I sort of feel like it might be pretty emotional. Also, it's the first time that I will have played. I'm not going to play the whole new record, but I'm going to play some. And it'll be the first time for at least a few of those songs that I've really played them on stage. And that's always, you know, one of the just sort of personally, musically hardest things about the timing of this record coming out during the pandemic is that like going on tour with a record is really when you learn so much about that record during that time. And that's when you really like get, you know, playing the songs night after night over and over, you really like get to understand them more and you really bond with them in a different way. And so I don't know how to do without that, kind of. Like, I don't know. It's like the people, I don't know. There's so many different layers. I think it's going to feel like a lot of feelings. Hopefully I can like
do it. Hopefully I can remember how to do it.
But it's very exciting. Just the idea of being able to play music and have people visibly hearing it and responding in real time sounds great, because, you know, we've been doing all these live stream shows and it's like so much better than nothing. And I'm so grateful for them. But it's very weird to just play a show to your computer screen. You know, it's like a very strange thing. And so just the idea that there's going to be people with faces that I can see sounds almost like too much to even believe.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, if I were you, I wouldn't be surprised if you get up on stage and you just feel like every single feeling that you've ever felt.
Yeah,
you know,
that's kind of what I think might happen.
Yeah.
I know.
But I guess if I could give you any advice, you should probably just narrate how you're feeling on stage the entire
time.
In real
time?
Yeah, because the people in the audience are probably also feeling very similar things.
I know.
Because they haven't seen a live performer for so long. I had a chance to see Lori McKenna when she was playing in Passim.
Oh, yeah.
And it did feel like that. You definitely feel this like warm, sparkling, magical feeling that I haven't felt in such a long time. So it's like, I think it's going to be a collective experience of just like unknown, uncertain, but like wonderful feelings.
I think so.
And also
too.
Maybe a little stage fright.
Probably that too. You know, music is the thing that opens the door to our emotions. Like, that's its job, really. And like that's its job for human society. You know, like, that's why there's music at ceremonies of every kind. That's why there's music in church. Like we were talking about, like, music opens the door to the other layers of your existence that you can go through your day kind of ignoring or walling off or whatever. And so that's like, you know, living in that all the time is pretty intense to begin with. But then when we're all so disconnected from so many of our like coping mechanisms and so many of our people and so many, you know, everything, I just feel like that there's like so many doors to open. And yeah, it could feel like a lot.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Oh man. All right, one more thing before we go.
Yeah,
this is gonna be very fun. You're gonna love this. It's called the lightning round. Okay, it's very fun, don't worry.
Okay,
here we go. Chris Delmhorst, what was the first song you learned on the guitar?
Shit. I'm going to say Fast Car, but that's not true. I definitely learned some other things first.
I will accept Fast Car. Batman or Superman?
Batman. But I'm thinking of the TV Batman. I don't know if I get to specify.
Sure.
That's my Batman.
Like the one,
the corny guy with like the pow signs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. What is your karaoke song?
Ooh. I have a few. I like Wind Beneath My Wings.
Oh my god. I'm just like trying to, it's a mess. It's so good. Wow. All right. I see a Club Passim show coming up. Chris Delmhorst karaoke. Chris karaoke. Okay.
You got a guest artist.
Besides now, what has been your favorite age and why?
I'm tempted to say like 22, even though it was a hot mess of a dumpster fire, but that like is so just that moment of all potential is something that I wouldn't want to do it again. Don't get me wrong. Not for one second. I wouldn't even really want a day of it back, but I feel fond about it now that it's safely over.
I like it. Dogs or cats or something else?
Well, both, but my dog is in the room. So I'm going to definitely say dogs.
Done. What is your coffee order?
Americano. Light on the water. Usually what I just say is lots of room for cream, even though I'm not going to put a lot of cream in it, but I don't want them to put much water in.
That's good. Yeah. First album you bought with your own money?
Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack. Baby.
No.
Yes, wow. I'm not lying to you.
What is on this soundtrack?
Axel F. That's all that mattered. It's the thing that goes do 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 do.
Oh yeah.
Do 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 do.
First concert.
Duran Duran.
Last book you read.
The Yellow House by Sarah Broom, which is a really beautiful memoir of her growing up in, well, more her family history in New Orleans.
it's amazing. I recommend it.
Flying or invisibility?
I hate it. I always hate this. I hate this question. Flying.
Why do you hate it?
Because I want both, and it makes me anxious. But I really, I'm going to say flying.
Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Wars, 100%.
Where is the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
Glacier Bay, Alaska.
Nice. That is all for the lightning round. You did pretty good.
Thanks. So how'd I score?
You scored 100%. You got all of the answers right.
Yes.
Chris Delmhorst, thanks so much for talking to me. We had a very good conversation. I would give this interview an A.
So much grading. Thanks, Cindy. It's really great to talk to you.
Basic Folk is produced by Laura McCarthy and Adam Corey, with Laura producing this week. Our business manager is Lindsay Myers. Alexander Stanton of the band Townspeople does our music. Basic Folk is proud to be a part of the American Songwriter Podcast Network. I am the host of this podcast, Cindy Howes. You can find more about all the episodes at my website, cindyhowes.net, and you can listen wherever you get podcasts. And if you liked listening to this, please share it with a friend. You know, send your friend a podcast. That's what they want. They just don't know that they want it. Anyways, thanks, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.